Back in the 1940s, when we were in the midst of World War II, and I was so 8, 9 years old, the crops by July were drying up. The pastures were slim. The oat crop was not much of anything. The corn was withered. Every afternoon when the chores were done, my pa and I, we'd stand out by the barn and we'd look to the west to see if the weather had any hope of a rainstorm. And my dad was very good at predicting the weather by looking at the western sky and the weather vane, the wind direction and the cloud formations. He could predict the weather. Well, this particular afternoon, after evening, and not seeing any sign of a storm, he saw something I couldn't see. He said, "See those clouds on the horizon? I could barely see them." He said, "I think it's going to rain tonight." Came into the house, lit the lamp on the table. It was just getting dark. And we were all sitting around, Dad reading the newspaper, and my brothers and I fooling around with something or other. About 9 o'clock, my mother said, "Well, it's time to go to bed." And so that's when we went to bed. Generally blew out the lamp, took my lamp, went up to bed. My little room was on the end of the house. The two windows in the bedroom were open and stifling hot in the bedroom. But I had hoped that Pa was right, that it might rain. And it must have been about midnight, and I heard this growl, this thunder in the distance, that wonderful sound. When it's dry weather, you listen for the growl of the thunder in the distance. And then I got up and looked out the window. It awakened me, and I saw a flash of lightning. And another louder clap of thunder. And the sky was a menacing conglomeration of clouds rolling and tumbling and fighting with each other, which I could see with each flash of lightning. And then Pa called up the stairs. He said, "Boys, wake up. Wake up and come downstairs." He did that maybe once or twice a year because he wanted everybody dressed in case the wind did something to the barn. Or if there was a terrific hailstorm, lightning struck something. The Wildrose Fire Department remained in Wildrose. And if there ever was a fire, and a lightning fire was not uncommon, we were on our own. And the worst possible thing that could happen to a farmer in late summer, when the barn was full of hay, was to have lightning strike it and destroy the winter's supply of hay. So he was deathly afraid of fire, and lightning was one form of it, of course. And so we were all in the dining room, watching out the window this storm, this menacing storm. And why in heaven's sake did the storm have to be so mean? Why couldn't it just rain? My mother would ask that question. The storm got closer, and this gust of wind came. And it shook the windows a little bit, but it wasn't that severe. And immediately, the temperature dropped probably 20 degrees, at least 10. And there wasn't any hail, but it just dumped. The rain came down, and if you ever saw a family happy with an event that was as natural as rain, it was at that time. Because farmers, if they had nothing else going for them, they always had hope. And the hope was, in this instance, was for some rain. Because it would save the crops, it would save the garden, we would have something to eat during the winter, the cows would have some feed again. And Pa said, "You can go back up to bed now." He looked at his watch, it's 3 o'clock. "You've got a couple of hours yet before you have to get up." Crawled into bed, and 5:30 the next morning, it all started over again. What we ordinarily did on a rainy day would crawl up into the barn and listen to the rain drum on the barn roof. Wonderful sound, never forgotten it. The smell of sweet clover and drying alfalfa. I was afraid Pa was going to say, "Let's go hoe the potatoes. It stopped raining, just a little drizzle." But he didn't. He said, "You know, this might be a day to go fishing." He didn't say that very often in the summertime. We fished a lot in the winter, but in the summertime, there was work to be done, always work to be done. So I found the 6-tine fork and went out back of the hen house and dug some worms and put them in a can. Found the 16-foot long cane poles that we had tucked under the corn crib eaves, tied them across the top of the 36 Plymouth, piled in the Plymouth, and drove over to Norwegian Lake. And Pa knew the Andersons, who lived at a farm right by the lake, and they rented boats. The boat rental was $1 a day, and a day was an hour or 12 hours, whatever you wanted to call it. It was $1. And so Pa went in the shed and picked up a pair of oars. We drove on down to the lake, and here were these were all wooden boats. They were, I don't know, somebody made them, I suspect. And they were sort of half sunk in the lake, and we looked around to see one that looked like would be halfway decent, pulled it out, tipped it over, dumped the water out. All crawled in, and we rowed out to where the marl hole was. Many of the lakes had marl bottoms. Marl is calcium carbonate, thousands of years old from various seashells that have accumulated there. And then it was dug out. Farmers used it to fertilize, to change the acidity level of their fields. So there's a big hole in Norwegian Lake, probably 40 feet deep. And the idea was no anchor was big enough, long enough, to chain the rope to drop down 40 feet. So the idea was to row right up to the edge of this marl hole, because on a hot day in summer, the big bluegills and the big northerns are down deep where it's cool. And Pa knew this lake better than we did, and we're rowing, he's rowing, and we're looking. And we see the bottom disappear. And Pa says, that's it, we're over the marl hole. Now we gotta back off just a little bit. And we backed off a little bit, and we dropped the anchor. And we started tossing our poles, our bobbers, into this deep hole in the marl hole. And we'd hit it. This was the day to catch fish. Soon, the bluegills were biting. I mean, my brother Donald's bobber went under, and up came a big bluegill. My dad's bobber went under, another big bluegill. Mine, Daryl's, and soon the bluegills were accumulating. What we did not pay attention to was that there was water accumulating in the floor of the boat. The thing leaked like a sieve. We didn't realize that. And I said to Pa, I said, Pa, I think this boat's leaking. And he kind of looked down and he said, yeah, but the fish are biting pretty well. Maybe one of you, well, both of you, we had a little pail along, you could dump some of the water out as it accumulated. And so we're dumping water and catching fish and just continuing to do that for about an hour, but we could not keep ahead of the water that was accumulating now up to our shoes and covering our shoes. And I said, Pa, this boat's going to sink. We had no life preservers. There wasn't anything like that. And Pa didn't seem to mind that the boat might sink because the fish were really biting. I mean, we'd had 25, 30, 40 bluegills. And I'm not exaggerating. The bluegills were this big around. I mean, they were just wonderful. But if the boat sank, well, what difference would it make? And we're quite a ways from shore. We're a good 100 yards, maybe more than that. And we're bailing and still fishing, and Pa finally says, I think we probably ought to hang it up for the day. We got enough fish, and now the boat's got, I don't know, probably that much water in it. We just couldn't bail fast enough. We got the boat up to shore. We were there safe and sound, got home, cleaned the fish. One of the things we had learned early in all of these adventures, never tell Ma any details of what went on, because she would have chewed out my dad like you can't imagine. So we're all smirking as we're cleaning these bluegills, and Ma's prepared with the great big old cast iron skillet on the wood stove, put in a big hunk of lard and put these fish in there and fry them up and crisp. And my dad said, there's nothing sweeter them bluegills caught in cold water. And we had a wonderful fish dinner and a memory. Are we going back to Norwegian Lake? And if we do, let's remember the boat that we were in and not select that one again.